Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a program which gives local authors a chance to read their literary prose. In anticipation of Memorial Day, our story tonight is about World War II and the sacrifices made by the millions of servicemen and women who served during those trying years. Our author is Fresnan Jerry Fisher, and she entitles her story, Auf Wiedersehen, My Love. And while she tells us that her story tonight is fiction, she reminds us that it is based on indisputable facts. And here is Don Weaver reading, Auf Wiedersehen, My Love.
My mir bist die Schein, you've heard it all before, but let me try to explain. My mir bist die Schein means that you're grand. My mir bist die Schein, it's such an old refrain, and yet I should explain. It means I am begging for your hand. I could say Bella, Bella, even say Wunderbar. Each language only helps me tell you how grand you are.
Some sixth sense warned him of danger even before he could smell the acrid smoke. They had been hit. The ruptured duct was on fire. The lumbering B-17 had become a second home to him, and when he realized they had to ditch, his first thought was for his crew. Jump! Get out of here now! He screamed at his co-pilot. Watching the last one of his crew bail out, for one long moment, he considered staying with his beloved plane. Oh, what the heck, he thought. I've always wanted to see Germany. He crawled on his belly to the yawning door, yelled, Geronimo! And tumbled out into the frigid, unwelcoming, smoke-filled enemy air. Drifting slowly to earth, he watched his B-17 nosedive, disappearing from sight in the dense forest below. They had flown 14 missions over Germany together. The duck had never been grounded because of mechanical failure, never aborted a mission, never failed to drop its bombs on target, even today, on this ill-fated run over the marshalling yards at Hamm. He hit the ground with a thud. Slightly stunned, he lay there struggling to remember instructions on how to ditch. Quickly removing his parachute, he checked his revolver and got out his book on German translations, all the while looking around for sight of the enemy. But there was only the eerie quiet. Lucky enough to land in a small clearing, he grabbed his parachute and ran over to the edge of the forest, where he buried it in the soft, damp earth. Studying his compass, he set out in the direction he assumed to be the Dutch border. First Lieutenant Kelly McClellan was known as one of the best pilots in his squadron. After training in California, he had been stationed in England for the past year. Tall, blonde, with a reddish streak in his hair, blue eyes, and even features, he had a blasé, cheerful manner that made him enormously popular with the other pilots and with the ladies. He made people laugh, and they loved him for it. With his rakish air and good looks, he wisecracked his way through life. So far, it had been a charmed one. He came from a small town where he was well-known and well-liked. Kelly never took anything seriously. Always ready with a joke, he coasted through high school. The testing to get in the Air Force almost threw him, but he managed it to become an outstanding pilot. Even now, he never doubted his luck would hold, and he would walk out of Germany. Soon he came to a narrow dirt road, which he continued to follow while keeping in the cover of the trees. He plodded along, deep in thought, about the predicament he was in, wondering how many of his crew had survived, and if he would run into any of them, when he was surprised by a group of young boys and very old men marching in loose formation, carrying shovels and hoes. He surmised they were on their way to fight the fire caused by his plane. Kelly never hesitated. Checking his book of German phrases, he sauntered up to the little group and gave a snappy salute. "Guten Morgen," he said. "Do any of you gentlemen happen to speak English?" One of the young lads stepped forward, smartly returning his salute. "I do. I speak English," he boasted. "Good boy," Kelly took out his map. "Now it seems I've lost my way. Can you point me towards the Dutch border?"
"It is that way, sir, about 50 kilometers," the boy volunteered.
"Danke, you're a real pal. Here's a chocolate bar to divide with your buddies." He saluted them again. "Well, gentlemen, this has been a real pleasure, but I must be on my way. Auf Wiedersehen, you all.
Auf Wiedersehen, they yelled in unison as he sauntered off down the road, grinning and waving. They stood there watching him for a moment, then huddled around the boy with a chocolate, salivating at the thought of such a rare treat. Kelly smiled as he trudged over the dirt road, marveling at his good fortune. However, he knew he had to find shelter for the approaching night, realizing how tired he was. Seeing a light in the distance, he decided to investigate. It was a small farmhouse with the barn attached, the custom for the area, in order to conserve heat in the cruel winters. The farmers kept the animals in the barn, thereby utilizing their body heat to warm the living quarters. Without a thought for his safety, the exhausted American pilot staggered into the barn and crawled on top of the hay, devoured one of his candy bars, lay down, and passed out. Near daylight, he began to dream. He was a little boy again visiting his grandfather's farm in Missouri. They had gotten up early to milk the cow. The harsh sound of the milk rhythmically striking the metal bucket fascinated him then, but now he smiled in his sleep at the familiar sound, struggling to come awake to be with his dear grandfather again. He opened his eyes with a start. Someone's in the barn milking the cow. Sensing danger, he fought to get his wits about him. Finally awake, he stared at the sight before him. Wearing a rain slicker and boots, a beautiful young woman with long braided blonde hair wore a determined frown as she attacked the udders of the cow standing there placidly chewing its cud. He watched her for a few moments, debating whether to risk letting her know he was there, having heard a lot of stories about downed American pilots and their reception by the German public. His usual brashness and empty stomach won. He blurted out, "Hey, honey, how about a glass of that milk for my breakfast?" With a look of sheer terror, she leaped off the tiny stool, spun around, grabbed a pitchfork, and lunged at him. He rolled over, springing to his feet. When she momentarily lost her balance, he tackled her, throwing her down on the pile of hay. She started to scream, so he clamped his hand over her mouth. "No milk, huh?" he quipped, grinning at her struggles. "Guess a plate of ham and eggs is out of the question?" She giggled. "Does this mean the Fräulein speaks English?" She nodded. Slowly, he removed his hand from her mouth. "It does. Now get off me." He hesitated. "I'll make you a deal, Fräulein. If you promise not to scream or try to run away, I promise I won't hurt you. Okay?" She looked up into his face, studying him, then nodded, "Yes." He rolled off her, and they lay there side by side in the hay, still panting from their scuffle. Finally, he spoke. "And so, Fräulein, who are you anyway?"
"My name is Marlena."
"Well, Marlena, Kelly here. Now, where are we?"
"The nearest village is Kamen."
"And the Dutch border? How far is that from here?" She sat straight up, staring at him. "Are you crazy? You'll never make the border. Troops are swarming all over the country looking for you and your crew. Give yourself up before some civilian kills you, like my mother-in-law, for instance."
"Mother-in-law?"
He reached over and gently brushed a strand of hay from her hair. "Ah, Marlena, don't tell me you're married. I guess you know you just broke my heart. By the way, where is this lucky guy?" She sighed. "Oh, don't worry. There's no husband. He was killed in North Africa. I came here to help his mother when she became ill. I take care of her and do the chores."
"Gee, that's tough."
He sprang to his feet and gave her an elaborate bow. "Let me introduce myself. Lieutenant Kelly McClellan of the United States Air Force, trying to get to the Dutch border before I get captured." He was watching her face as he spoke. "I was just wondering, Marlena," with that lopsided grin, "are you going to help me, or are you going to turn me in?" Without hesitating, she replied, "I'm going to help you, Lieutenant." Marlena was as good as her word. She brought him thick slabs of brown bread, cheese, a whole quart of milk, plus some delicious apple strudel. Quietly studying him, she sat there while he wolfed down the food. Later, as they shared one of his American cigarettes, she pleaded with him to surrender, warning him of the danger he was in, since the authorities might appear at any minute to search the premises. She told of German girls who helped the enemy. Their hair was shaved off, swastikas painted on their scalps while they were stripped, and marched naked down the main thoroughfare of the nearest village. The people jeered as they kicked and spat on them. "You can't stay here. When Mama sleeps again, I will bring you a map to memorize. Then you must go." At the crestfallen look on his face, she said, "Now don't look so gloomy. I told you I wouldn't turn you in. You must trust me." A few hours later, she returned with some blankets and a bucket of water so he could bathe and shave. They began to talk, filling in the blanks of their lives. He learned she was 28,
had been a teacher before the war and that her husband, an officer in General Rommel's tank corps, had been killed at Tobruk. Green eyes flashing, she paced back and forth. You wonder why I help you? I'm bitter. I have good reason. I hate the Nazis. Hitler is destroying my country. My life is over before it begins. I have nothing to live for, not even a child. And oh, how I wanted a baby. You're not going to cry, are you? Kelly asked, reaching for his handkerchief. No, I've cried all my tears away. But you wanted to know why I help you? I tell you why. I want this horrible war to be over. We cannot win. Kelly's heart went out to this beautiful German girl who was risking her life to help him. He reached over to take her hand, gently pressing her palm to his lips. Ah, Marlena, don't give up. You're too young to give up. When he touched her, she drew back, startled, then reached up to feel his forehead. Why, you're burning up. Do you have a fever? Why didn't you tell me? You can't leave like this. You'll get pneumonia. Oh, I'll be all right. Do you have aspirin in Germany? She chuckled. Of course we do, silly goose. We invented aspirin. Now cover up good with that blanket and try to rest. I'll be back as soon as I dare. It wasn't long until she returned with another blanket and two aspirin. She reminded him to drink lots of water. These should help you sleep. I will check on you as soon as I put Mama to bed, but it may be late. She gazed at him with those green eyes. You probably have influenza. Don't worry, Lieutenant. I'll take care of you. It was after 10 o'clock when she returned to find him delirious. He was shaking with a chill from head to toe, yet burning up with fever. She made a quick decision. She led him inside the house to her bed. Piling blankets on him, she also brought a warm brick from the kitchen for his feet, then curled up in the rocker beside the bed. Between caring for her mother-in-law and tending to the chores, she watched as he slept fitfully off and on for 3 days. Occasionally, she bathed his head or rubbed down his body, trying to break the fever. Once he opened his eyes to stare at her, asking, "Where am I?" then dozed off before she could answer. On the third day, while catnapping beside his bed, she heard a hoarse whisper, "Hey, you, my angel of mercy, come over here." She tiptoed to his bed. Folding back the covers, he motioned for her to crawl in beside him. She eased under the covers. He put his arms around her, then, without another word, lay his head on her shoulder to drift peacefully back to sleep. When he awoke the next morning, she was gone. He lay there studying her room. Bare walls. How sparse it is. Not like my sister's with the makeup, scattered clothes, stuffed animals, canopy bed. This room is different, stark, almost convent-like. He tried to visualize the drudgery and hopelessness of her life as he marveled at her acceptance. Kelly was overcome with feeling for this German girl who was placing herself in such jeopardy to care for him. He called to her, "Marlena?" No answer. Then louder, "Marlena?" She entered the room with his breakfast on a tray. "Shh," she whispered. "Do you want Mama to hear you? You must be quiet." "Oh, yeah, Mama. I forgot about Mama. How is the old gal? How did you get away with hiding me in here for—" He pondered, frowning. "Say, how long have I been in here? I've lost track of time." When he motioned her to come over to him, she set the tray down and tiptoed to his bed, gazing at him curiously before stretching out beside him. He looked into those green eyes, put his arms around her, nuzzled her, then brushed her lips softly with his. He felt her shiver. He traced a frown line on her face with his fingers, then slowly lowered his head to kiss her again, this time long and tenderly. She came up for breath, blushing furiously. "To answer your question, Lieutenant, you've been here for 3 days, and I've had Mama knocked out for 3 days. I doubled her sleeping dose." "You what?" Howling with laughter. She tried to shush him, but his laughter was contagious. She began to laugh, too. They rolled over and over, giggling, bodies entwined, trying to muffle the sound as they broke into fresh peals of laughter. Finally, they became still as he lost himself again in those green eyes. She ran her hand through his hair, and with her touch, he knew she wanted him as much as he wanted her. Sobered, he sat straight up. "You know, I probably won't get out of this alive. Who knows how long this mess will go on? We may never see each other again. For once in my cockeyed life, I want to be sensible. I care what happens to you. Marlena, think about it. Are you sure about this?" "I have never been more sure of anything in my whole life," she whispered, as she pulled his head down so their lips could meet again. In that instant, when their lips touched. He felt as if he had always known her, always known how it would be with her, always known the taste and feel of her. They forgot the war, forgot the danger he was in, forgot where they were, forgot the world, only knowing each other. It was as if time hesitated for one tumultuous moment. Much later, as it began to grow dark, they stood together in the doorway of the barn, his face pale and wan in the dwindling light. He looked down at her, searching for the right words to say before he left her. "Marlena, I..." She placed her fingers over his mouth. "Shh, don't say anything. Just go. Go and God bless." Her voice caught. He took her hand to slowly kiss her fingertips one by one. "I hope we meet again someday. I'll never forget you. I wish things were different. I wish..." He stood there helplessly for a long moment, then turned and strode off into the cold, dark night. As he moved away, he heard her whisper, "Auf Wiedersehen, my love." The prisoner. Cursing and stumbling throughout the long first night out in the elements, Kelly wasn't sure if he was headed in the right direction. His flight boots crunched on the icy ground in the pre-dawn stillness, frightening him into a mass of shivering indecision. The night was as black as blindness, although he knew he should be grateful there was no moon. Eventually, he curled up in a tight ball in the middle of a dense thicket, vainly trying to rest while keeping one eye open. Although successfully eluding capture so far, he was increasingly frustrated at how carefully the Germans manicured their forest, making it difficult for him to hide, and surprised at how densely populated the country was. The second day, a farmer plowed the field all around him while he remained motionless in a clump of debris. He slowly chewed on one of his remaining candy bars, a nibble at a time for nourishment. Every time he crossed a stream, he drank copious amounts of water to ease his hunger. On the third day, he sat down beside a stream to bathe his face. His recent bout with the flu had weakened him, so for the first time in his life, Kelly didn't feel his usual optimism. Cold and tired, he suspected he might be going around in circles. The rest of the day was spent struggling to sleep in wet clothes because of a drizzling, bone-chilling rain. Reluctantly, he resolved to surrender to the first German soldier he saw. At dark, he started out again, cautiously, for he remembered Marlena's warning about the brutality of German civilians toward shot-down Allied pilots. Furious at the relentless bombing by the Allies and incensed by the garbage spewed out by the Nazis, they sometimes stoned the pilots to death or beat them unmercifully before turning them in. Rounding a bend in the road, he almost ran into a German army supply truck. Standing in a ditch, relieving himself, was a German soldier, a corporal. He seemed to be alone. "This is it," Kelly thought. "Might as well get it over with." He walked up behind the soldier, tapped him on the shoulder, and said, "Dr. Livingston, I presume." To his utter amazement, the corporal threw up his hands. Kelly had to laugh. "9-9, I surrender, not you." The soldier stood there petrified, plainly not understanding a word. Kelly dug out his book of German translations. "Ah, here it is. Aufgeben, Aufgeben, I surrender, ein Aufgeben." The soldier stared, continuing to hold his hands over his head. Finally, Kelly gave up and said, "Oh, what the hell, Corporal? Let's have a smoke." The man's face lit up when offered an American cigarette. They sat there side by side on the edge of the muddy ditch in the still darkness, contentedly puffing away. Later, he convinced his captor to drive him to a civilian prison in the nearby town of Wehrl. Kelly spent the next 3 days in a solitary cell with only thin, watery cabbage soup once a day. Worst of all, he had no matches to light his cigarettes, since they had confiscated his lighter. By the time a guard came to take him to the interrogation room, he was pacing the floor, feeling edgy and irritated. It was a large room, dominated by a gigantic picture of Adolf Hitler. Though instructed by the guard to stand at attention, he plopped down at the huge desk in the corner of the room, arrogantly propping his feet on the desk, thinking, "What are they going to do to me, throw me in solitary?" It wasn't long before a portly, beribboned German officer entered. Kelly started to stand up when the officer said, in perfect English, "No, no, don't get up. You may sit there if you wish." Continuing to stand, Kelly spoke, Why, I wouldn't think of it, sir. Anyone can plainly see this is your chair. It has the imprint of your ass on it. The Nazi officer turned beet red, but proceeded to try the old buddy routine. He offered Kelly a cigarette, but Kelly refused. No, thanks. I prefer my own, since American cigarettes are so far superior to German cigarettes. Don't you agree, Colonel? Or is it General? But I'll bum a match from you. After a few hours of sparring, getting nowhere with questions about his unit and where he was stationed, Kelly was escorted back to his solitary cell. Shocked at how much the enemy knew of his squadron and its crew, he learned four had survived the crash, but was not allowed to see them. The worst part was not being allowed to smoke. This drove him up the wall, but after 3 days, his craving for nicotine became bearable. Finally, they shipped him to Sagan, in Lower Silesia, German-occupied Poland. When changing trains at Frankfurt, he saw a city demolished, almost ghostly, with gutted buildings and smoldering fires. A sullen, angry mob of civilians raised their fist, glaring at the American prisoners. The guards were extremely nervous, trying to rush the filthy, ragged bunch as they limped and stumbled along. When they were on their way again, Kelly heaved a sigh of relief. The brutal treatment of the POWs by the guards horrified him. Many had burns and other injuries. There were sprains, lacerations, and broken bones, but no medication or medical attention of any kind on the train. He noticed the guards sought out the Jewish prisoners to inflict unusual cruelty. Finally, they reached their new prison, Stalag Luft 3, where they were allowed a quick shower, then deloused while a group of smug German officers, resplendent in their Nazi uniforms, watched. As they marched to their barracks, Kelly studied the setup carefully, always with thought of escape. He observed guard towers at each corner of his compound, called goon boxes by the prisoners. He counted 17 barracks, each holding 140 prisoners. Sleeping accommodations were plain triple-deck bunks with mattresses made of burlap sacks filled with wood shavings. The floors were about 3 feet off the ground to allow security personnel, called ferrets, room to crawl underneath in order to detect tunnels or to eavesdrop on conversations. The food was atrocious, but the guards didn't have it much better. Matches were practically non-existent, and lighters were not allowed, so they lit their cigarettes off each other. During blackout, any room that showed even a crack of light was fired into, causing some of the prisoners to be injured while reading or playing cards. They became very, very careful. Plumbing was medieval by any standard, and the place swarmed with flies. The prisoners were lucky to get one shower a week in summer, less in winter. The tedious, mind-numbing days and months dragged by. Kelly found it to be an excruciatingly boring existence, while observing the guards become as apathetic as their charges. It was only natural some would get friendly, especially with Kelly. He was fun and funny, plus he was unfailingly generous with the coveted American cigarettes received in the Red Cross packages. These Red Cross packages saved them from starvation, and it became commonplace for some of the prisoners to share with their German guards. Each package contained one can of corned beef, one of Spam, powdered milk, a quarter pound of sugar, crackers and chocolate, 2 ounces of powdered coffee, and 1 pound each of margarine, prunes, or raisins, plus the precious American cigarettes. One guard in particular was very friendly. Kelly called him Wolfgang. A huge man with a bushy mustache and a florid pockmarked face wreathed in a perpetual smile, he had learned to speak English in hope of someday visiting a brother in Milwaukee. Kelly regaled him with funny stories and jokes. "I say, Wolfgang, if Hitler and Goring both jumped off a 10-story building, which one would hit the ground first?" The guard looked around furtively. "Ah, Kelly, you must not speak so of the Führer." Then he leaned into him and whispered, "Which one, Kelly?" "The answer is, who cares, Wolfie?" Wolfgang roared with laughter, slapped Kelly on the back and said, "Yeah, yeah, who cares?" Another time Kelly teased the guard, "Wolfie, what did the ram say when it ran off the cliff?" Beaming, the guard said, "I don't know. What did he say, Kelly?" He said, "I didn't see that U-turn." "Ah, Kelly, you funny man, U-turn. I get it. So funny you are." Thus a long, grueling 16 months went by. To help pass the time, Kelly studied German, delighted to understand when a guard complained the Russians had broken through across the Vistula. Hope. One day he found out Wolfgang was going on leave for 2 weeks in the same general area as the farm where Marlena lived. He decided to risk it, so asked if he would go by the farm and check on her. The guard was reluctant.
I do dis, maybe I get shot? Now, Wolfie, who will know? Just you and me, and I'll never tell. How about this? I'll give you all my American cigarettes if you will do it. Think of the beautiful Fräuleins you can screw while you are on leave. What's dis screw? Oh, come on, you know, Wolfie. Hanky-panky, boy and girl stuff. Don't you know about the birds and the bees, for Christ's sake? Oh, yeah, I know. I do dis for you. He nudged Kelly playfully. And for the Fräuleins, yeah? Okay, I do it. The next 2 weeks dragged by even slower than usual. Kelly paced the floor night and day, fearful the guard would back out or forget. He found it impossible to sleep, so learned to play solitaire. And then Wolfgang was back. He immediately sought out Kelly to tell him about his leave. Did you get laid? Yeah, I did. The American cigarettes, you know. You're pretty smart, Kelly. Good for you. Now tell me, in between getting laid and smoking my cigarettes, did you go by the farm like you promised? Yeah, I did. Nothing dare, Kelly. The fire burn everything. No house no more. Neighbors say old woman die, and mama and baby go away. Baby? The word struck Kelly like a sledgehammer. Could it be? No. But the time was right, and Marlena had bemoaned the fact she was childless. He sat down on his bunk, hard. Is that all you could find out? He asked. Yeah, that is all. Then softly, you care for dis Fräulein, Kelly? Yeah, Wolfie, I care for dis Fräulein. The burly prison camp guard leaned over and patted him on the back, then turned and tiptoed out of the barracks. For the first time since capture, Kelly lost his customary ebullience. He was aware he couldn't look for Marlena, even if he managed to escape. He knew German girls caught giving solace to the enemy faced a horrible fate, and chances of escaping his hellhole were nil. He lay in his bunk day after day, staring at the wall, heedless of the cold and the noise, listless and troubled. Suddenly, the camp was given notice to pack any food and blankets for a forced march westward. It was January, the temperature was below freezing, and the prisoners were in terrible condition. Scuttlebutt was that the Russians were closing in. The Germans wanted to get the American prisoners out of their reach, presumably so they could use them in peace negotiations. It was Saturday, January 27th, 1945. Wolfgang was distraught. He confided in Kelly, "You know, those Ruskies are the real enemy. You've in this war, you have to fight them. They no good, those Ruskies." Scared, hungry, heartsick, Kelly lashed out at him. "You know, Wolfgang, as I sit here rotting in your dirty, stinking prison, starving to death with barbed wire all around me, I think I can figure out who my enemy is without any help from you." The guard recoiled as if he had been struck. Kelly immediately regretted his outburst. "Oh, I didn't mean you, Wolfie. You've been a pretty good Joe. I guess I'm just down in the dumps." "I know. You're Liebchen, the Fräulein. Someday, when this war is over, I find her for you and bring her to Milwaukee. Okay, Kelly?" "Okay, Wolfie. Whatever you say." Around midnight, the entire prison population of about 20,000 men inched out of the compound, carrying their few meager blankets and supplies. The ground was covered with a light snow, and it was freezing. As the night wore on, many passed out on their feet. Hundreds fell asleep in the snow, never to awaken, while others, like Kelly, stubbornly concentrated on slogging along, one step at a time. On the fourth torturous night, a large building loomed out of the darkness. The guards quickly herded them inside, where they could feel heat emanating from a huge circular brick furnace in the center of the room. It was a ceramic factory, and the kiln was still warm. They crowded in like moss, drawn to the furnace and its heat. Kelly painfully struggled to pull his numb body up the stairs, where he found a spot to lie down, immediately falling into a deep, drug-like sleep. Suddenly he awoke, gasping and choking for air. When he tried to move, a terrible weight pinned him down. Frantically, he clawed and pushed until he freed himself from the packed bodies of his comrades, who had fallen asleep on top of him. Alarmed, he looked around him to see many dead or dying of suffocation. Trying desperately to get near the heat with their frostbitten hands and feet, the prisoners piled on top of each other, the ones on the bottom unconscious from exhaustion and unable to extricate themselves. He called out, wanting to warn them, but his voice faded away as he sank into another sleep. The next day they marched to Spremberg, where about 2,500 of the Americans were loaded on boxcars so densely packed they had to sit with their knees pulled up. They made a stop at Risa,
where they had 1,000 bowls of soup ready, way short of enough to serve 2,500 starving men. There were no sanitary facilities on board this train, and dysentery was rampant, so they did what they had to do when the train stopped, many times in plain view of gaping, menacing German civilians. Sometimes they couldn't wait until the train stopped. Eventually, they arrived at their destination, Nuremberg. It was Sunday, February 4th, 1945. This camp was unbelievably filthy, even worse than the others. No light, no latrines, very little food, and smelly, foul mud everywhere. Some of the men had not shaved or bathed for months. Almost everyone had a cold, and or the debilitating, unending, cursed dysentery. Rations steadily worsened. The prisoners searched for dehydrated vegetables with bugs and worms, hoping to eke out a little precious protein. Morale was at an all-time low. Lack of a proper diet made the prisoners lethargic, so they ceased to care about their appearance. To make matters worse, they had to cower in their barracks, listening to Nuremberg being bombed unmercifully by their own planes. One day, Kelly caught a glimpse of himself in a mirror. He stared, trance-like. Who was this gaunt, emaciated old man with the long, unkempt hair and the straggly beard? Where was that young hotshot pilot, so sure of himself not so long ago? "I'm still here," he thought. "I'm here, somewhere, and I'm going to make it. I'll show the bastards." Well, something inside warned, "Don't bet on it." On March 27th, news had General Patton only 50 miles away. The food seemed to slightly improve at this. So did their treatment by the German guards. The only thing that did not improve was the weather, which continued to be miserable. 2 wet, exhausting weeks later, after another forced march, they arrived in Moosburg, a POW camp near Munich. Morale had never been lower. Good news about the war was beginning to be greeted with a shrug. Most had given up. "The war will never end. The Germans will never surrender. Screw the war. Screw the Germans." One day, Kelly and another prisoner were huddled around a small fire they had built in the middle of the compound, trying to heat some spam from an American Red Cross package. Startled to hear the rat-a-tat-tat of machine gun fire, Kelly grabbed the precious spam and dove for cover. Then he realized the German guards were dropping their weapons while they also ran for cover. A low murmur began to grow and grow into a deafening roar, intensifying as the huge gates to the compound opened. Kelly slowly stood up and saluted as a jeep, followed by tanks and foot soldiers, entered. Standing tall in the lead jeep was the flamboyant United States General George Smith Patton, smiling and waving at the wildly cheering Americans, free Americans, no longer prisoners. 10 agonizing days later, Kelly was transferred to a camp in France called Camp Lucky Strike. From there, he boarded a troop ship for America. A few days later, he was in California at an army hospital. They examined him, miraculously giving him a clean bill of health. Then he was discharged from the United States Air Force. "I made it," he yelled. "I said I would, and I did. I beat 'em. I survived." It was May 1945, and the long war in Europe was over.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the boys are home again, all over the world, and rain or snow is all that may fall from the skies above. A kiss won't mean goodbye, but hello to love. When the lights go on again,
the shadows deepened, and the fire in the fireplace barely flickered as the little group sat around his chair, spellbound, listening as their grandfather related his story. "Gosh, Gramps, you sure were brave," one of the boys said, his voice oozing with pride. "Oh, not so brave, sonny. Most of the time I was scared to death like everybody else. More lucky, I think. Your grandmother, bless her soul, always said I was the luckiest man she ever knew. Incidentally, I never told her about Marlena." His oldest granddaughter wiped tears from her eyes. "But, Granddad, what about Marlena
and the baby. Yes. Well, I had a bundle of back pay, so I booked passage and sailed right back to Europe. I searched everywhere, displaced persons' camps, the neighbors' farms, the Red Cross. I never found a trace of them. Not a trace. It was like they disappeared from the face of the earth. I finally ran out of money, so I had to give up and come home. Do you think she's still alive, Granddad? For a while he didn't speak. Then clearing his throat, he said, Well, we'll never know, I guess. But I'll never forget her. She will always be alive in here, pointing to his heart.
Till the wells run dry and each mountain disappears, I'll be there for you to care for you through laughter and through tears. So take my heart in sweet surrender and tenderly say that I'm the one you love and live for. Till the end of time.
That was Don Weaver reading Jerry Fisher's story, Auf Wiedersehen, My Love. Goodbye, my love. It's a story of what happened to the pilot of a B-17 bomber whose plane had been shot down over northern Germany. It probably happened about a year and a half before the end of the war. As we heard, after bailing out of the damaged B-17, the pilot, Kelly McClellan, befriended a German girl, Marlena, for a short time. She probably saved his life when he was desperately ill. The two of them fell in love, and although the story doesn't actually say so, we're led to believe that she had a child by him. After they separated, he turned himself into the Nazis and spent 16 months in a German POW camp, often only surviving on the packages of food supplied to prisoners by the American Red Cross. Because of the cruel treatment, horrible food, and several harsh forced marches, many of the POWs didn't make it. And of course, we were very much relieved that despite all that he went through, the lead character in tonight's story, Kelly McClellan, did survive. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer will be Flora Beach Burlingame. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.